Hey, this is Scott Love, host of NALP Talk. Thanks for joining us on another episode. Today, our guest is Christine McKinney, Chief Operating Officer of Fish & Richardson, and we're going to talk about change management. Christine, thanks for joining us on NALP Talk today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited about this because this is an important topic that's on everybody's mind because of all the change going on right now. And you have a unique blend of credentials. You have a master's in change management from Northwestern, paired with over two decades of leadership in law firms. Tell me a little bit more about your career path, Christine, and how having a formal change management framework has influenced your career choices.
Absolutely, Scott. I started in the industry about 25 years ago as a legal personnel assistant. It was followed shortly by a role in recruiting and then a diversity role. And that was back when we found jobs by mailing in resumes and looking in newspapers for positions. So it's been a minute. And in the early to mid 2000s, I really realized that a lot of my work, particularly in diversity, was about helping organizations change the way they had been doing things for, you know, decades, if not hundreds of years, to adopting new ways of working. And that really influenced my decision to pursue graduate work in change management. And I was living in Chicago at the time, and Northwestern had an incredible program. And that was a pivotal moment in my career. I think it gave me both kind of the framework and the language to make change in my organizations and really understand how to have that influence. Another key turning point in my career was really around the pandemic, when there was so much rapid transformation happening, you know, in the world, in our organizations, and workplace operations and communications and employee expectations were, you know, changing so quickly. And I think I really realized in that moment my background in talent and in change could be aligned with operations, which up until that point was not something I'd ever considered. Frankly, I was in my dream job. I was, you know, the chief legal talent and inclusion officer at Fish and really loving my work. But around that time, some other leadership transitions were occurring in my firm, and it created an opportunity for me to think differently about my career path. And really watching all of that change alongside the leadership team already in place at the firm gave me the confidence that I could, you know, pursue a role in operations. And I've now been COO for 5 years. So it's been a wild ride. No day is the same, but I'm having fun.
Well, I think that's fantastic. And I appreciate you sharing that. And I can definitely see how having a formalized structure in your education in such an important area, coming into legal where you know it, can give your firm a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
Not just in how they thrive, how they attract talent, but also in how they serve their clients. And I think that's interesting. And I think that's what's unique about the legal industry. And I know, and you know this, and everybody listening to this knows this, that generally speaking, change can be difficult for individuals on a personal level. Then we compound that when we think of change for organizations. So what do you think, Christine, if anything, makes the legal industry even more challenging in that regard?
Oh, Scott, that's a great question. I want to sort of digress for just a moment to share a memory that sparked for me from grad school where, you know, I think about it all the time. It was a course on designing strategic change, and our professor had us keep this change journal for the entire quarter. And here's me, a new grad school student. I'm working in the legal industry during the day. I'm going to class at night. And I'm thinking, you want me to like basically keep a diary? That's kind of a weird assignment at a prestigious grad school. But, you know, the point was we were supposed to pick something we really wanted to change for ourselves. Like, I want to eat more vegetables. I want to reduce my use of plastic, improve my tennis game, whatever it might be. And then write a few sentences each day about our progress in that. And I can't remember what I selected as my change goal. But what I do remember was, in addition to all the readings we were doing for that class, it struck me how hard it was to really make change for myself in something that I wanted to do, right? I had selected what I wanted to change, and it was hard. And it really reinforced that fundamental lesson that, like you said in your question, I mean, individual change is hard even under ideal circumstances. And then we compound that to an organization, and it's really hard. So grounding in that, I think, you know, it does get even more tricky in the legal industry. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One is that, you know, lawyers are trained in law school to rely on precedent, to look backwards, right? To analyze what's worked before and to build from that. So, you know, that creates one challenge, particularly in a time right now around rapid innovation. Another one is that lawyers are trained to be skeptical for their job, their issue spotting around every corner, trying to, you know, manage that risk and brace for impact, if you will, and convincing, you know, that sort of paradigm to make change, I think, does create more challenge. And finally, and there's plenty of research to show this, that lawyers also place a uniquely high value on autonomy, on being able to control their own destiny. And so in my experience, that combination of precedent, skepticism, and autonomy really can make organizational change, you know, extra challenging to implement.
Right. So let me ask you this along that line.
Yeah.
Because most of the change theory that you've probably been taught was around the corporate structures. You talked about how law firms, they're different. They're partnerships. You've got 200 owners. And it carries a completely different set of cultural dynamics. So how do you translate these corporate change theories into strategies that actually work with law firm partners? What do you think about that, Christine?
That, you know, I think the core principles are probably very similar, right, at their core. But I do think the change happens in how we approach implementation. So, you know, I think in a law firm structure in particular, you have to have more of a ground game approach, right? Success is going to depend less on a top-down directive and more on engaging stakeholders across practices, offices, et cetera, right?
So grassroots, right?
Right. That sort of partner, you know, partners are owners. So it creates you have people that might have to vote to adopt particular changes. And that creates a different political dynamic, of course. I do think, you know, if I can get nerdy for just a minute, there's a couple like change management theories that are probably worth just mentioning at a high level, because I think they impact how we do this in law firms a little bit differently than others. One, I think a lot of people are familiar with, you know, John Cotter and the 8-step changes, but his first step is the burning platform, right? The concept that until it's on fire, people are not going to change. And I think we're seeing this right now in the legal industry because, you know, for the first time, AI is really shifting how we go about doing work. And I've heard for 20 years that the billable hour is dead and it's going to die and all these things, right? But I really think there's this potential burning platform. People are feeling that, and it's changing our conversations around AI. And I think that that's, you know, sort of concept works in law firms very well. Another one is William Bridges' transitions model. And our NELP audience, if they've ever heard me talk about change, I talk about Bridges and transitions every time because it really gets to the heart of people in change, right? That change is not an event, it's a process. And Bridges talks about there being sort of an ending and a beginning, but in between all of that is this neutral zone. So, you know, you take a law firm merger, one firm ends, you come in the next day and there's a new logo on your computer. So the change has happened. But as human beings, we're moving through that in what he terms the neutral zone. And that's where anxiety is spiking, where engagement is dropping, where you're seeing employee attrition. And I think in law firms, because we are much flatter than a corporation, that paying attention to your people in that neutral zone is exponentially more important. I'd say one more that I think is probably true in both law firms and in corporations, but because of that increased skepticism is even more critical in the legal industry, is the five whys, the Ono's five whys, which is exactly what it sounds like really get to the root cause of something. Why are we doing the change? Well, why does that matter? Well, why does that matter, right? You can go on, and you can see why lawyers will have that conversation with you. They're not always just going to accept the, well, this is why we're going to do it, right? There's going to be a like, but why? And I really love that about working with lawyers and working in law firms. I think that engagement helps us get to better places because we've kind of refined our approach. We've had, you know, those conversations. So happy to talk more about any of those, but I just had to geek out for a moment.
That's right. And we could spend hours talking about this. That's something I've seen also from my work, recruiting partners. That's a big change, especially if it's with a group. I've even done law firm mergers before. And I think the critical component that has to be there when there's that type of organizational change is trust. I think trust of the leadership has to be there. So let me ask you this then, in change management, getting buy-in is everything. And I like the way you said it's really at the grassroots level, or at least that's how I describe what you were talking about, because these are owners there. Who are those critical stakeholders you need to get on board first when launching a firm-wide initiative? And how do you handle the inevitable naysayers? What do you think about that, Christine?
Yeah, I think at a real practical level, there's certain groups in every organization that if they're not on board, it's a non-starter, right? For me and my firm, that's our operating committee, our management committee, our practice group leaders are involved in all of that. But when I think about sort of critical stakeholders, it's not just those folks. It is the naysayers you mentioned. And I think a common mistake we often make as leaders is not spending enough time with those people. It can be really hard and frankly exhausting to engage with the skeptics. You know, I might be really excited about a change for my firm, or I might see why it's a business necessity for my firm. And it's easier and frankly more fun to focus my time and energy with the people that are on board, right? That are excited about the change. But I got to say, some of the most valuable conversations are with the people who are resistant, right? Or even just uncertain, right? They don't even have to be resistant. They're just skeptical or uncertain. And
why are those valuable, Christine? Why do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they make, well, I would say it this way. It's valuable to have those folks in the conversation because they surface the concerns, the obstacles, the blind spots, I would say, that I might not see. And understanding where that resistance might come from allows me and my teams to sort of refine our approach or rethink things. And I think leaning into those difficult conversations as leaders really sheds light on the spaces we need to better explain. And I use the word conversation here very specifically, Scott, because this is not something that happens over email. I see people making that mistake, particularly in the world we live in, that's it's hard to catch people, right? And we're working hybrid and all these things, but it is a coffee chat or it's a Zoom conversation or a Teams conversation. It's not something you can just do on email. And so I'd encourage people to have the conversations with the skeptics.
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. And we hear also, Christine, about change fatigue, especially over the last few years with tech disruptions, shifting workplace models. How do you diagnose change fatigue in a firm? And what steps would you take to mitigate that before a project derails?
Gosh, change fatigue is at a level I have never seen in the industry. I'm seeing it in my teams and my colleagues. I see it in myself. I see the rapid pace of change. And, you know, whether it's coming from the technology transformations, whether it's leadership transitions, workplace strategy shifts. I mean, there's just so many things happening in legal industry in particular. It feels like an endless list. And then we compound that with change happening outside of our workplaces, right? People have access to information like they've never had before on a global scale. And there's this increased sort of stress and anxiety that people are bringing into work. And you bring all of that together and try to help folks get sort of on board about change. And people are tired for good reason. And so I think the concept of really managing change fatigue might be impossible in its purest form. But I really think to mitigate it, it means we prioritize, we sequence change effectively, and we have discipline to stick to that whenever we can. And I think, you know, one of the things I do with my team is get the organizational or the executive leadership group together. That's our chiefs, directors. We talk about upcoming changes. We do our best to talk about how they're going to impact, you know, our employees. And I have to say, I think IT departments have done this for forever. They sort of have roadmaps and they map things out. I think on the talent side, we've been less conscious of mapping out change for people. And so I get all these, you know, our chief team together and we talk about which changes need to be sequenced when, and maybe we decide to hold off on something that one of our departments is really excited about, or we know we need to do, but we understand because X, Y, and Z has just happened, it's not going to be a good time for people to embrace that change. And so again, it gets back to that discipline of really sequencing what's going to make the most sense, knowing, of course, Scott, like the world is unpredictable and there's always going to be a new change that's lobbed in a way we didn't expect.
Right. And as an active NALP member, Christine, you know how critical talent management, recruitment, and professional development are to a firm's success. How can legal talent professionals, those people listening to the show, how can they use change management principles to improve the adoption of new internal programs or professional development initiatives?
Yeah, I think NALP members are so uniquely positioned to do this kind of work. So I would have a few pieces of advice. One, build relationships across departments in ways that you might not even think about, right? Create those genuine connections, of course, with your colleagues across talent functions, but think about legal admin assistants and paralegals or office services and IT. So many change adoption initiatives require folks from across the firm. And so I think building those relationships, I'd say obviously building relationships in NALP, having people that you can call when you want to get the pulse on something going on in the industry. I mean, we always love to know what other firms are doing. And it's nice also when another firm has walked the road before you and you have somebody you can call to say, what'd you learn from that? What do you wish you would have done differently? I think that going back to the explaining the why is so important. I think, you know, a good example in the legal talent industry right now is the recruiting timelines are changing, you know, drastically at a really fast pace. And our, you know, NALP members are in the weeds on that and are going to webinars and are talking to each other. And that's wonderful. What they need to remember to do is explain to all the lawyers with whom they work what is happening. Because lawyers, particularly those who have been in the industry, they remember what I remember when I started, which was fall recruiting, right? They remember how that happened. And so explaining to them many times, not just once, why these changes are happening, how you're responding, what your plan is, because they're not in the weeds day to day. So I think, you know, to do this as legal talent professionals, we have to remember to explain those whys. And frankly, there's a burning platform moment in legal recruiting right now. And folks can really embrace that to innovate and try new things.
Yeah. And when you're looking at a massive operational overhaul, whether it's a new tech stack, a restructuring, or policy shift, what does a communication strategy look like from the COO perspective?
Oof, I'm tired just talking about it, Scott. There's so much communication, I think, because we talked about that sort of grassroots, right? I mean, again, every major initiative is going to start with leadership alignment. I think if you don't have key leaders aligned, it's unlikely to succeed. So I think that and then engaging sort of the operational leadership team who's going to have to implement whatever change we're talking about is really thinking about whoever those, you know, office managing partners might be or key stakeholders on the kind of ground game on the local office level, it's important that they really understand. So there's this whole kind of communication cascade, but I would say something unique that we've been doing at Fish for a number of years now is that our president and CEO, he and I do a roadshow every fall where between sort of Labor Day and MLK, we visit every Fish office. And these visits include sort of small group meetings with every cohort, right? And we have some operational updates, but they're very informal. They're, you know, around tables, they're over meals, and we solicit questions and we have really candid dialogue with employees at every level of the firm of what's going on and what they can anticipate coming. We try to preview some changes so they start knowing. And we get to hear concerns that are on people's minds. And sometimes, you know, they're really easy and we can dispel a myth that's been flying around the firm. And sometimes, you know, you're on your third or fourth office and you realize, oh, wow, there's a theme going on here. Maybe we really need to revisit that change. And I think those interactions really help us keep a pulse on sort of change and firm culture. And so I think from a COO perspective, you know, I really think about the whole organization as it's like a baby mobile over a crib, right? We can't boil the ocean. We don't want to shake the mobile so much that people are feeling seasick, if you will. But where are the little dings we can make that send right. that ripple change throughout the firm?
That's great. I appreciate that visual you gave also, Christine. That's great. And so how do you measure the success of a change initiative? You've gone through it. Is it purely based on ROI and adoption metrics, or are there qualitative signals that you look for that tell you a new culture has truly taken root?
The measurement question. Scott, there's like so many dissertations on this, and I am absolutely not an expert. I don't have all the answers on that, but I will say I've gotten more comfortable with it over the years. And I do think, you know, one of the best indicators is, you know, adoption metrics, right? You launch a new system. Are people using it? You know, obviously tech examples are an easy one, but I think in the talent space, one of the things we did when we were coming out of the pandemic and, you know, we don't have specific in-office requirements, but we've been trying to encourage people, you know, offer the carrots to come in. And so 4 or 5 years ago, we launched Colleague Connections, which was a very informal principals or our partners were given $1,000 a year to connect with their colleagues, take them to lunch, have a coffee, that kind of thing. And our professional development department has been tracking not only the utilization through reimbursements, but who are people taking out? Are we making sure that that's an inclusive thing, that there's not just one group in an office that gets to have coffee, but our paralegals are included, or our, you know, reception staff, or whatever that looks like. And I think we've kept that program partially because it's super popular and we know that through utilization. So there are ways to kind of have that data. We also do, you know, an annual engagement survey, which I think is becoming a little more common in law firms. I find it one of the most helpful tools we have to see what's resonating with people. You know, we get both kind of the quantitative and qualitative in that. And then, you know, we get those results and then we announce some of them back on our roadshow. We tell people what we heard. And, you know, this is where leadership's going to try to make new advances because there's either a reality or a perception that we've got a gap somewhere, or these are the things employees really love and appreciate and we don't plan to change, right? It's that kind of tie back to your ROI metrics into the communication. It all comes together.
Right. And with the rapid rise of generative AI and evolving client demands, legal industry's facing an unprecedented wave of disruption, as you know. What's one piece of advice, Christine, you'd give to law firm leaders that feel overwhelmed by the sheer velocity of change right now?
You know, I'm going to take the liberty and give two pieces of advice, Scott.
Sounds great.
I think the first is recognizing that change is hard. And that goes back to my memory from grad school. I mentioned at the top of our conversation, right? It's difficult. And so when it feels hard, just know that that's normal. That's a reason to sort of persevere and be resilient and be patient with yourself and your colleagues. It's often a symptom that you're doing things right. You know, assuming you're kind of taking the right steps, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. So I sort of say, like, be gracious with yourself when it feels hard, because with how fast, you know, Gen AI and all these rapidly changing demands are happening, we're getting a lot thrown at us. So, you know, it's okay that it feels hard. That's normal. The second is absolutely you have to build relationships with, you know, your trusted peers who understand the challenges of leading through change. And so I have a number of friends, both in the industry and outside, who, you know, are people that I can call. I also have a very tight, small group of folks that I've known kind of, frankly, over mergers over the years. And there's, you know, a core group of us who get together annually. And that's my sort of ride or die people, that they've become my friends in that time of personal and professional crisis and celebration. And I feel like having those people who understand our industry, you know, is such a helpful. And I, you know, we talked before we started recording, Scott, a little bit about my family. I have one daughter, my husband of 26 years. I mean, they're my biggest cheerleaders. And so when it is tiring, it's awesome to know you have sort of interests and loved ones outside of work. Because not every change goes great. And as a leader in this environment, you know, not everybody's like singing your praise every day. You have to find those people outside of the workplace. So having that community to share ideas and be encouragement, you know, for one another is critical.
That's great advice. And one final question for you, Christine. If our listeners, many of whom are legal talent and administrative leaders, if they want to start building their own change management toolkit today, where do you think they should begin?
Oh, I'm going to put a plug in for William Bridges' Transitions book. I have two copies because my first is just highlighted and underlined, particularly doing change at the intersection of people, which really all changes, but, you know, in the legal talent space. I think, of course, taking advantage of organizations like NALP or the PDC or others, you know, in our industry, where you can have some online learning or attend a conference, read the newsletters, the articles. Something I tell folks to do is invest in their own growth, you know, consider working with a coach, find a mentor. And sometimes those, you know, a coach might be something you have to pay for yourself. And at certain points in your career, that investing back in you is really, really important. So I think there's a lot of things you can learn online. We were talking about generative AI, like use AI, ask your tool, you know, what it would recommend, ask for a skeptic's perspective, perhaps. I think there's a lot of things we can learn from technology. So I would say start by reading and start by talking to people. I could go on and on, Scott, but I know our listeners, I would probably appreciate me stopping there.
Well, you've given us some great advice, Christine. I want to thank you for being here on NALP Talk today, for sharing your advice and your expertise and really your warmth and your heart. I think that's a big part of that. You're obviously very sincere about what you do. And I want to thank you again just for being on the show today. Thank you, Christine.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. It's been such an honor.